This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
New monster heat waves are killing people across the world. The old, children, infants, mothers, simple outdoor workers. A new analysis shows oil and gas production from just five well-known corporations will kill at least 5 million people by 2050, and maybe more than 10 million people. The real cost of burning our way into the future comes alive with guest researcher Sarah Bierman-Becker from Global Witness. Longer, hotter heat waves are here already and worse to come. From Utah State University, we speak with co-author of New Science, Dr. Wei Zhang. Plus, you get global heat news your media leaves out, and two little AI-made climate songs. Pay attention. We will test. Are you a human? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to another hot edition of Radio EcoShock. I am seeing scary things. The heat in China, and especially Japan, is just right off the charts, beyond any previous records. The Guardian reports in early April, quote, "Schools close and crops wither as historic heat waves hit Southeast Asia. Governments across the region grappling for response as temperatures soar to unseasonable highs." Rebecca Ratcliffe writes, "Thousands of schools in the Philippines have stopped in-person classes due to unbearable heat. In Indonesia, prolonged dry weather has caused rice prices to soar. In Thailand's waters, temperatures are so high that scientists fear coral could be destroyed." End quote from The Guardian. And then there is the African time bomb, the one you haven't heard about. Zimbabwe just announced a total 100% crop failure. The government is advising people to conserve food. News reports say the United Nations admits it cannot get enough aid in there. A state of emergency has been declared in neighboring Zambia and Malawi, also suffering from the worst drought in 40 years. This ghastly situation will eventually bubble into Western news for a few seconds and then disappear. Famines have wrenching effects beyond hunger and starvation and weakness for disease. For example, some parents in the region are selling their children for marriage because they cannot feed them. Young women from Malawi have been scammed into so-called jobs in the Middle East as servants, but discover they are trapped as slaves. Deutsche Welle TV did a feature on that. Anyone who has enough money for an airline ticket or people smugglers will seek refuge for food and security, maybe where you live. The situation in South and East Africa is heating up. Did we make this mass drought more likely with our emissions? I have not yet seen the climate attribution studies, but I'm sure they are out there. What we're seeing here are long climate waves. In science, there are long waves that travel around the globe called Rossby waves. The heat and drought wrecking less developed countries is kind of part of such a wave. It begins in big fossil fuel-burning countries and then carries change everywhere around the world. Something in Europe can cause changes in the rains of Zimbabwe, amplifying a natural cycle there into unsurvivable extremes. Here in British Columbia, in some places, people walk their dogs in a caked, dried-out riverbed that should be a roaring river this time of year. Fear of wildfires is palpable for the coming summer. A few have already started. Winter was so mild here, at our house we burned a third less wood than in any of the 10 years previous. My garden is dry and kind of dusty in this April rainy season. About 80% of the wine and fruit from the renowned Okanagan Valley was killed by a freak cold snap last November. Fruit prices will be through the roof, and some vintners may go out of business. It takes 3 to 5 years to start a new grape orchard, with many ongoing costs and no income. I lost track of the extent of the coral damage around Australia. There are so many reports. Coral reefs seem to be in a death spiral. They are, or were, nurseries for about a quarter of all commercial food fisheries and a billion-dollar tourist draw for Australia. Maybe wondrous corals have a right to exist on their own, outside the economy and our edutainment. It's too bad people in every city near and far are killing them off. The ripple effects of ocean warming and marine heat waves will be surprising and extensive. None of that makes the news.
Everything you read in the mainstream media is 100% true. Please, go back to your jobs. If you have not got a job, you are a worthless human being. Consume, consume, consume until we have no planet left to consume. What you need to do is buy things that you don't need. That's the best way to support the economy.
Before we go to our guests, a program note and a nagging question. Can I replace Alex Smith with computer-based intelligence? I've looked into it. We begin with a test of two AIs designed to write complete songs from a few words prompted by the human user. I'm going to play you two short examples with all the instruments and voices generated by AI. The lyrics on one song were written by a human, and the other by AI. This only takes 2 minutes. See if you can tell who is real. I will reveal the answer at the end of this show and post the lyrics in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. So here we go, two short AI climate songs.
In the dark, there's a shadow that's growing long. The world on fire, where did we go so wrong? Ice is melting, oceans rising to the sky. No escape from the truth, it's do or die. The earth is bleeding, crying out for us to hear. But we're blinded by our greed, consumed by ticking time is running out fast. Will we wake up or let the future be the past? I see the melting horizon, a warning in the night. Our planet's pleading, can't you see the light? We hold the power to turn this around. Let's save our world before we all drown.
Fires race across the poles. The sea is coming in. Heat reaps away souls. Hot and humid, not best for humans. The sea is going still. 1, 2, 3, for what are we waiting for? 5, 6, 7, 8, hope it's not too late.
At the end of the show, I will tell you which AI created those climate song clips and which lyrics were written by a human. Let's go to our guests. America has never produced more oil and gas than today. Let's translate that booming success into people who will die because of it. Analysis by the nonprofit group Global Witness finds products from major Western-owned oil and gas corporations will kill millions of people around the world. Mass heat deaths have already arrived, and the big heat kills are yet to come. Nobody reports that on their balance sheet. Global Witness does. We reach senior investigator and author of the new analysis, Sarah Bierman-Becker. from the UK. Sarah, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
Many of us drive around in fossil fuel-powered cars, buying fossil-based products. A lot of pension funds and bankers depend on those rich stock dividends. Why did you look at the deadly side of the business?
We know that fossil fuels are causing a lot of damage through climate change, but often it can still be a very abstract concept that doesn't necessarily mean anything to people. So we wanted to bring home the impact of fossil fuels in this analysis, because we need to show how dangerous they are to the extent that millions of people will actually die just as a result of heat from using fossil fuels. And it's not necessary. There are alternatives available that we can use instead. And that's why we decided to look at this.
Your recent report highlights the impact of emissions from just five major fossil fuel corporations. Could you summarize the key findings for our listeners?
Yes, absolutely. So our analysis found that 11.5 million excess heat deaths globally are estimated as a result of just five Western oil majors' production from now until 2050. And that's the result of the emissions occurring from the oil and gas that those five majors produce. And the ones that we looked at are European ones, including Shell, BP, and Total Energies, as well as US-headquartered ones, including Chevron and ExxonMobil. And when we talk about excess heat death, this is a sort of sounding a bit like it's quite a technical term. What it means is they're additional deaths that are premature and wouldn't have occurred otherwise at that point in time. And they're really related to people dying as a result of heat.
And these are real people. These are kids. These are seniors. These are people we love that will pass away.
Exactly. And that's only the people dying as a result of heat that we've included in our analysis. You know, that's not even touching on all the other ways in which climate change is going to cause damage through impacting agricultural production and what that means for access to food, you know, people potentially dying because they have less access to food or famine as a result of drought, diseases spreading because of changing temperatures, floods. So there are lots of other risks that arise from climate change that we haven't included in this analysis.
And so many people fear this dangerous heat will come in coming decades, but is it already here?
Yes, absolutely. And you touched on this in your introduction. Climate change is here already, and so are the dangerous impacts of heat, because we are already seeing the impacts of climate change on temperatures. 2023 was another record-breaking year. And we know that these are temperatures that are rising because of emissions. A recent study actually found that more than one-third of nearly 30 million heat-related deaths recorded globally over roughly the past 30 years were linked to climate change. So that's 10 million people already over the past 30 years. And this is happening across the globe, in China, South America, the U.S., Europe.
It happened here where I live in British Columbia and coastal Vancouver, which is always cooled by the ocean. Over 600 people died in 2021 in the Great Heat Dome, so nobody gets away for free with this one. And I always refer to the amazing killer heat in Europe in 2003. Over 60,000 people died. It was jaw-dropping, and yet people seem to have forgotten about it. But now we find, after pretty late and slow reporting from governments about excess deaths, we don't need to go that far back. How many Europeans died in the summer of 2022 from heat?
We now actually know that it was 61,000 people in that searing heat in Europe in summer 2022, which is just a shocking number.
But I thought after the 2003 heat deaths that Europeans reconsidered the way they do holidays and communication with the elders, stay in touch. Some cities instituted cooling centers and health check phone calls for vulnerable people and better public warnings. A few people installed air conditioners. How could Europe still lose another 60,000 people to heat?
I think that's a really good question. It's probably because we're still not well prepared for the sort of heat that we're seeing as a result of climate change. It's unprecedented. Increasingly, new records get broken every year. And it's also that the vulnerable populations aren't being protected enough. You touched on this in your question earlier also. These are real people. These are people that we love. Those who are most vulnerable are children, the elderly, low-income communities, outdoor workers, and pregnant women, and also socially isolated people. You know, at least in the case of socially isolated people, they might not have anyone to call, or they might not be, other people might not be looking out for them. So there are a lot of groups of people who aren't being protected from these unprecedented heats. I think also maybe governments and maybe some members of the public still aren't aware of the impact that heat can have and what needs to be done to protect people.
Well, Sarah, if Europeans with their wealth and development and technology can't stop heat deaths, what chance is there for people of India, Zimbabwe, or Central America?
That's a really good point. And this is a real climate justice issue, because the extreme heat that we're seeing is the result of climate change that has been caused by people who aren't the ones who are going to be most affected. You know, it has the worst impact on the world's poorest, who are actually those least able to adapt to higher temperatures and who've also done the least to contribute to it. So it's really unfair. There's research showing that countries like Afghanistan and Papua New Guinea and whole regions like Central America are amongst some of the places most at risk from extreme heat due to rising temperatures and lack of access to healthcare and energy to help them cool off.
The Indian Meteorology Department just warned of heat waves lasting 10 to 20 days during April to June this year. As reported by the Washington Post, quote, India has no idea how many people its heat waves are killing. How were you able to estimate heat deaths in countries where death records are not available?
Clearly, lots of governments aren't recording these heat-related deaths well. It's definitely been an issue in the UK where I live, because often figures that we see that are reported in the media may actually be an underestimate of actual deaths because of how the death is recorded in the hospital. People might record it as, for example, heart attack, but then it's not recorded as being directly linked to or as a result of heat. And so we didn't come at it that way in our analysis. We used a methodology developed by a researcher at Columbia University who came up with a model that estimates the mortality cost of carbon, so how many people die as a result of an additional ton of carbon emissions through heat. And so it's a model based on past data, but it's really about estimating and predicting what will happen in the future. And that's how we came to our result of finding that 11.5 million excess heat deaths are predicted until the end of the century from those carbon emissions from the five majors.
Usually we find emissions assigned by countries. New in your Global Witness analysis is calculating direct deaths from corporations selling fossil fuels. And some of these corporations have budgets bigger than poorer countries where more heat victims live. Why pick the big corporations, and how did you select them?
This is a key point for us and what we wanted to look at in our analysis is the companies that are responsible for producing fossil fuels, because they bear a large chunk of responsibility for climate change in many ways. You know, they produce fossil fuels, but they have also prevented climate action towards transitioning to renewables by spreading climate change denial and lobbying against alternatives. We selected these five companies because they are the five largest integrated private sector oil and gas companies based on revenue in 2023. There's also the fact that the five companies we selected are headquartered in the West. We have a better chance of getting them to change. And there are lots of other oil companies around the world doing this as well, and they also bear responsibility. It's not to absolve other oil companies of it. It's just that we wanted to highlight these five oil majors' contribution.
Should we presume there will be millions more deaths from the production in Russia, Saudi Arabia, Norway, Canada, Australia, the whole list?
Yes, absolutely. We only looked at the responsibility of the five largest Western oil majors, but any company will have the same responsibility. Each emission is equal in this methodology. So, yes, absolutely.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is researcher Sarah Bierman-Becker from Global Witness. We are discussing the deadly consequences of continuing to produce oil and gas as the planet overheats. The world's largest integrated oil and gas company is Aramco, based in Saudi Arabia. In Houston on March 18th, the head of Aramco, CEO Adam Nasser, told a conference, quote, "We should abandon the fantasy of phasing out oil and gas and instead invest in them adequately, reflecting realistic demand assumptions." End quote. He got applause from oil executives in the room. Sarah, when I hear that, I think of your report that millions of people far away who got no profits out of it will suffer, starve, and die of horrible heat. How can the fossil fuel industry just keep making money when we know who pays with their lives?
Yeah, you raise a really good point there, and this is a real problem. I think we need a fundamental change in our energy system to address this so that those who are responsible for causing these deaths are the ones who have to pay towards the alternative of transitioning to renewable energy. Because companies that have profited are still actively blocking the transition to cleaner and more affordable energy. I think partly we need governments to step up and take action. They need to really regulate more. And there's also the issue that companies are still investing in oil and gas infrastructure. Really, the money that they've made, the profits that they've made, and the figures are really high and hard to imagine, should be going towards renewables and not invested in new oil and gas. There are campaigns to make oil companies pay, but we need more of that, and we need governments to act on that.
How did research at Columbia University help you estimate coming heat deaths?
We used a methodology called the mortality cost of carbon, and that looks at what will happen as a result of one additional metric ton of carbon emitted. And this model describes that every 1 million metric ton of carbon emitted will cause an additional 226 excess heat-related deaths over the next 80 years. So then we took the production data from those five companies, converted that to the equivalent carbon emissions, and were then able to calculate the resulting heat-related deaths.
And that research has been published, and I will put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.org for people who want to follow up on that. Where did you get estimates of the oil and gas expected to be produced between now and 2050?
We have access to a database, which is called Rystad Energy. It's an energy business intelligence agency that has field-by-field description of the upstream oil and gas market globally, and it covers the periods from 1900 to 2100. So there's a lot of data available there, and it's a very reputable database. Many media organizations and international bodies like the International Energy Agency use it, so we know that this is a good source for this sort of data.
How many lives would be saved if humans do react soon and manage to achieve net zero by 2050?
This is a really important point because the research that we've presented is obviously very depressing. These numbers are so high and it can feel very doom and gloom, which it is. But there is a flip side to this, which is if we think of reducing emissions, then those are millions of lives saved. And in the methodology that we use, there are two different models. One for what happens if the world continues on business as usual and high emissions, which is what we've presented in the analysis headline. But there is also what's called a low emission scenario, which describes what would happen as a result of the five majors' additional emissions in a net zero world. So if the rest of the world makes a real effort to reduce emissions and reach net zero, then we would see those deaths halved. So we'd be at around 5 million deaths instead.
You know, fossil fuel companies, with their public relations and highly placed lobbyists, will claim they do not burn fossil fuels very much. We do, you and I. Why blame them?
I think this is a somewhat unique problem of climate change. They dig up the fossil fuels, but we use it. But the fossil fuels wouldn't exist without these companies. And they have also been involved in the systematic spreading of climate change denial, and combined with lobbying, that's really slowed the transformation towards an energy system filled with renewable energy. They're finding lots of strategies to artificially increase demand or keep demand up rather than allowing or supporting societies to transition. And we sometimes use this analogy of, you know, drug dealers will claim that they're not responsible for drug addiction. People want to, these are products that people want to use. The same with the arms industry, you know, weapons producers would maybe say that they don't kill people, but they are to an extent also responsible for bringing these products onto the market. We argue that the same applies to fossil fuel firms.
You must have run your analysis by some of the big oil and gas companies. Who responded and who did not?
We had responses from Total Energies and BP. They gave a somewhat more detailed response. We didn't hear back from Chevron or ExxonMobil, but Shell responded saying they would not provide a comment, but they didn't recognize the conclusions of the analysis. They didn't agree with the analysis. Interestingly, Total Energies in their response also said that they do not agree with Global Witness's inclusion in the analysis of so-called Scope 3 emissions, which are the emissions arising from burning the fossil fuels or the oil and gas that they produce, so when people use them. And that's exactly the question we just discussed, you know, people using these products. So why should they be responsible? But because they're producing and digging these fossil fuels out of the ground, they also bear responsibility.
Do you think people with cars and holiday flights really want to know? Is it hard to get these basic facts out into this media entertainment bubble?
It is an uncomfortable truth, but I think that people do want to know the facts and know what is happening and what they can do. A lot of people are trying to take action, and I think there can also be some frustration with feeling like individual people are being blamed, and that's actually been part of the fossil fuel industry's strategy. There have been campaigns to individualize this problem and say, oh, but people are using the products, exactly the topic we were just talking about. But I think it's important to think about who's ultimately responsible and who has profited from these fossil fuels, which brings us back to the companies. And also what must be done to change it. In terms of the media bubble, we got covered by The Guardian, a newspaper in the UK, but with a global remit. And that shows that there are outlets willing to cover this.
Tell us about Global Witness. How was it founded? Where do people work? And what are your specialties?
Global Witness was founded in 1993. By three friends who came up with an idea to look into a certain topic. One of the first things that Global Witness worked on was looking at the funding of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, who use timber trade with Thailand to fund themselves. And this was one of the first things that the founders of Global Witness looked into. Nowadays, the work has expanded into many different areas. We have people looking into deforestation, the threats stemming from digital companies and misinformation around climate change being spread by platforms. We also have a team looking into critical minerals and how to responsibly transition to renewable energy and the problems related to that, as well as the team that I work on, which looks at the role of fossil fuels in climate change. And yeah, there's other things we look into, but that's just to give you a bit of insight into some of the work. People are based in different areas. We have offices in London, in Brussels, and in Washington, D.C.
From the UK, we've been speaking with Global Witness Senior Investigator Sarah Bierman-Becker. Find the analysis called The Supermajors' Plans Could Kill 11.5 Million People at globalwitness.org. That's globalwitness.org. And you can find further notes on this interview at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you for helping us add up the real costs.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A new report finds 80% of the world's CO2 emissions are produced by just 57 companies. The Carbon Majors Group tracks real responsibility every year. Surely 57 companies could transition, contract, or shut down, slashing most greenhouse gases. That could save the world as we know it, along with all existing coast species. It sounds worth it.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Do you think heat waves are coming more often and sticking around longer? You are not wrong. The first global study of heat during climate change is out. In prestigious Science Advances, the title is Anthropogenic Forcing Has Increased the Risk of Longer Traveling and Slower Moving Large Contiguous Heat Waves. This is information you need to know. We reached co-author Wei Zhang, assistant professor at Utah State University. From Logan, Utah, Dr. Zhang, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Years ago, heat waves happened, but they did not last that long. The government of India just released a warning to expect extreme heat lasting 10 to 20 days at a time. Why did your team decide to study changes in heat waves?
So our team has been studying heat waves for a long time. In particular, we want to study the intensity, frequency, and the underlying magnitudes of heat waves across the globe. This study, we were talking about the contiguous heat waves across the globe. So we were checking the spatial and temporal propagation of those heat waves. And we come up with a very nice story that focuses on the moving speed, traveling distance, and the lifespans of the heat waves. Yeah, so I think because, you know, the heat wave is has such major impacts on our communities, on public health, and in particular those people who do not have the access to AC and to cooling centers, and those heat waves are dangerous.
And it goes well beyond human health, which is serious, but we also have what other things? We have things like wildfire risk, and what else were you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, the heat waves can not only influence public health. Yes, I totally agree. They could also influence the wildfire risk and air quality. So those heat waves can influence the ecology systems. Has not only impact on the human society, but also on the environment.
How do we know heat waves are lasting longer than they used to, even in the 1980s?
So the study we did is that we look at reanalysis data. We look at, you know, the estimates of the real climate system. We call it reanalysis data, which is a combination of observation and modeling output. That's the best we can get. We look at three data sets, including the data from ECMWF, which is in the European Center for Mid-Range Weather Forecasting. They have the EI-5 data, and we also look at the NASA's MERA 2 reanalysis data and the NOAA's NSEP-2 data. So we first checked that those heat waves from those three data sets, and then we look at that database we created by using the three data sets, then we calculate the trend in the moving speed of those heat waves. And we found a very significant decrease in trend since 1980. We found that trend, then we also look at the modern output. You know, we look at numerical models. We found similar results. So that signal is pretty strong and significant.
In 2021, a deadly heat dome settled over the Pacific Northwest. People huddled indoors and hundreds did die. And the awful heat seemed to just stall overhead. Is this a new phenomenon? And is there evidence global warming is part cause of slow-moving heat?
Yeah, so when you look at our results, that slowing down is almost consistent across the globe on many regions. In order to find that signal in the anthropogenic forcing, we look at experiments from the CMIP-6. We look at the experiments that when we have all the forcings, including greenhouse gases and the natural forcings such as solar irradiance, volcano eruptions. So when we have all that forcings during the historic period of time, that decrease in trend in the moving speed of the heat waves can be reproduced. But if we only put that natural forcing in the model, that trend disappears. And if we put that greenhouse gases into this model, that decreasing trend in the moving speed of the heat waves shows up again. So we are pretty confident that the decreasing trend in the moving speed of the heat waves is largely caused by anthropogenic forcing.
What do you mean when you say heat waves propagate? Does that mean spreading in space and time, or can one heat wave actually split up to become several?
No, so the propagation means the moving of a heat wave from one region to another. The beautiful thing about this study is that, you know, we could actually track that propagation of the heat waves, because usually, you know, we talk about heat waves. For example, the one you mentioned in the Pacific Northwest, you know, we have that region of heat wave. Basically, it means that, you know, that temperature is extremely high across that region. So we look at a few days or so, we define a heat wave there. But for our study, we actually track that propagation or the moving of the heat wave. Because we are using that 3D tracking algorithm for the heat waves, we look at that in each spatial grid, how would that spatial grid with that heat wave could propagate to the next day and to the next region. And we could check that during a historic period of time. So we have an inventory of the heat waves that traveling around the globe land region. So we could have that information, you know, about the moving speed, about the traveling distance, and about the lifespan of a heat wave.
Heat waves can drift across whole continents. What drives their motion, and do they generally go from west to east, as the majority of weather systems do?
Yes, the majority of that traveling is from the west to the east, but there are also some other traveling directions. For example, for the United States, some heat waves that could travel from the south to north due to that a climate system called the Bermuda High, which is, you know, the subtropical high weather system, that very high pressure system could shift from west to east and can move from north to south, from south to north. And that could need the heat waves to travel from south to north. So, but in majority, those type of heat waves are traveling from the west to east because of the jet streams in the mid-latitude region. Because, you know, when we try to understand what drives the propagation of the heat waves, we found out that those high-frequency waves in the climate system, those waves are kind of weakening. And those waves are guided by, we call the jet streams, you know, very high-speed wind systems in the upper troposphere, you know. So those jet streams are, when we look at the wind speed, is also decreasing. And those jet streams move from the west to the east. To understand the mechanisms of those propagation of heat waves, we look at that we call the air-kinetic energy, which is basically, you know, that driving force for those atmospheric waves and also the jet streams. We identified some decreasing trends in those waves and in the jet streams based on historical data. So we use that mechanism to explain the slowing moving speed of the heat waves.
In this paper, you and your colleagues make a first attempt at describing changes in global heat waves. Did you find a one-size-fits-all golden rule of heat waves, or were there a lot of differences between continents and latitudes?
Yes, there are regional differences, as you can see from our study, that when we look at this trend, or you know, the overall trend in terms of the moving speed that's decreasing and the intensity is increasing, the traveling distance are increasing, but there are some regional discrepancies. You know, for example, there are some trends that's stronger in a period of time, but that trend could be decreasing a little bit for another decade or so. There are definitely some regional discrepancies, but you look at that signal across the globe, that trend is really strong and robust.
How big is the average heat wave, and how big can they get?
As you could see from our study, that we definitely look at the accumulated areas. So actually, in this study, we more focus on those heat waves that has an accumulated region around 1 million square kilometer. So we kind of focus on those heat waves. You know, the heat waves could even be larger than that because those heat waves can propagate across the globe.
Diagrams in the paper suggest the largest, most intense changes in heat waves are not in the tropics, where it is already hot, But in the temperate zones of North America and Eurasia, plus a bits of Australia and the southern tip of South America, we know there are serious heat waves across the Sahel in Africa right now, with countries like Burkina Faso going above human tolerance, even in the shade. Why don't these tropical areas show big changes on the maps in your paper?
We can look at the historical data. Those tropical regions, yes, they definitely are influenced by heat waves already because tropical is basically has a higher temperature than the others. And for our study, you know, we look at those data sets that, you know, we look at the three data sets, and including SMWF, including MERA2, including NSEP2 data, and all those data sets are pointing to the same direction. Of course, it's like pretty common for midland region, but, you know, in the tropics, yes, they also have very strong heat waves.
You are with the Plant, Soils, and Climate Department at Utah State. Please explain the feedback from dry soil to hotter heat events.
Yes, my department, we have basically three sections. You mentioned plants, soils, and climate. We have faculties that's working on plant science, and we have faculties working on soil moisture, and we have faculties working on climate dynamics modeling. And I am one of them who works on the climate dynamics and climate modeling. So the heat waves or the extreme temperature that coupling with soil moisture, that has been reported already over the past years or so. So that soil moisture could really provide that feedback to the heat wave. They are actually coupling. You know, the extreme temperature could be enhanced by that dry soil, and that dry soil could even feed back to the heat waves. It's a fully coupled processes. This could also, because when you think about the impact, you know, the coupling of the heat wave and the soil moisture, because, for example, the Western U.S., which is already entering kind of mega drought condition, and in particular in the 2021, 2022, you know, the Western U.S. was under severe drought. And that drought condition or that dry soil, you know, could be further enhanced the heat waves, and the heat waves could also feed back to the dry soil. So these coupling processes could have a really strong impact on the societies, you know, including, for example, wildfires. And they could damage the agriculture. They could also exacerbate air pollution. So all those, you know, climate systems are coupled and connected.
How did you test whether these changes in heat waves were driven by human-induced warming instead of just natural cycles?
In the climate science, if you want to make some arguments on that detection attribution, we have to use global climate models, because only these models can help you to tease out that impact of natural variability and external force signal or anthropogenic force signal. It's still pretty challenging to argue that this trend was caused by natural variability and non or external force signal and non. You know, so here in our study, we use a multi-ensemble of climate model experiments to do the detection attribution analysis. So we found that only we prescribe the greenhouse gases in those model simulations, we could reproduce that decreasing trend. But we cannot see that natural variability doesn't play a role here. But what we can see is that anthropogenic forcing did play a dominant role in driving those decreasing trends.
This study is an assessment of heat waves over the past 40 years. You do not make predictions for the next 40, but given what we now know, do you have ideas on what to expect if we continue with the record high levels of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere?
Yeah, so that's what we're expecting. If the greenhouse gases emission continues and we don't have actions that take it to mitigate greenhouse gases, I think that those trend is going to be continuing. So based on the mod experiments, based on the results we have put together in the paper, that's what we're expecting.
Do you think the changes in heat waves can be reversed, or are we stuck with these new hot spells?
I think that depends on how our society work together to mitigate carbon dioxide or the greenhouse gas, or we call it carbon pollution. Also, there are many projects that's going on to advocate for, you know, carbon sequestration technologies. If our international society, our different countries could work together, come up with a great plan, you know, to mitigate carbon dioxide, I think we still have some great hopes, you know, to maybe reduce the trend or even overturn the trend. But that depends on how much efforts we can do for the mitigation, for the carbon sequestration.
As we wrap up here, what will you be working on next?
So right now, I am working a lot on the climate adaptation science. You know, of course, I'm a climate modeler, and I do a lot of work on climate dynamics, climate modeling. But I am also working a lot on climate adaptation science and instructing the climate adaptation science program here at Utah State University since 2021. And we are more educating our students to develop that actionable science. For example, if we know that the heat wave is going to increase, how could we work with the stakeholders in cities or in rural areas that, you know, to come up with some plan to mitigate that heat and to better adapt ourselves to this heat? So, for example, you know, we have been working on a few projects to adapt to extreme heat, to maybe bring trees to urban areas or the other disadvantaged communities, you know, to have that trees, you know, to using the evaporative cooling to reduce the environmental temperature. And we engage the citizens to be aware of this extreme heat. For example, last year, I led a project in Salt Lake City, you know, to engage citizens to do an urban heat mapping project. That project was funded by NOAA. So we engaged more than 40 volunteers to measure their real temperature in different locations of the Salt Lake City. And I think that's really to help those communities better prepare for this extreme heat. And I do a lot of work with USDA, you know, to bring in trees to the communities. Yeah, I think that's some work I'm working on. I'm still working on a lot of work on climate modeling, you know, to simulating drought, heat waves, and I'm also doing work on climate adaptation and mitigation right now.
That sounds like really interesting outreach work that you are doing. From Utah State University, we've been speaking with Dr. Wei Zhang. He is co-author of a revealing new paper about changes to heat waves as the world warms. The study published in Science Advances is Anthropogenic Forcing has increased the risk of longer traveling and slower moving large contiguous heat waves. Find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Wei Zhang, thank you for helping our listeners understand this.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. It is time for the AI reveal. The first longer song called Melting Horizon was written entirely by Suno.ai. This was the best songwriting site so far. I also tried Sonato.ai, but found the music pretty bad. Maybe I just need to refine how I use it. The lyrics were also trashy, but as you heard, the quality of their vocal was outstanding. I have used computer-generated voices for over 20 years, and that was the best I've heard, so I hastily wrote the lyrics myself for the second song clip and let her rip. You could strip the vocal out of any song with free tools. You could generate your voice in one AI and develop it in another. Free artificial intelligence is a playground now in its infancy. I will probably make some new songs for the show. But as a former musician and a friend to other musicians, I hear a big change coming for creators who are already struggling to survive. Is AI a culture killer, a gift to humans, or both? At first, it sounds like I can retire and let AI produce Radio EcoShock. Theoretically, it would not be that hard. It depends on the second step of AI coming along. It's in its baby stage now, the development of agents that anybody can use without computer skills. I guess step one would be the EcoShock agent would scan thousands of science journals, press feeds, news items, YouTube, and social media to develop guests. So I asked Microsoft Copilot, the free version, to suggest guests for this program. Copilot produced a list of 10 people, 8 of whom were already on the show in the last year or two. Copilot just mirrored back my own program. I tried fine-tuning it, but really this AI is operating in a limited box, namely the internal data it has already scanned. When I complained to Copilot, it said the AI had no direct access to the net, but operated on internalized data. The search was incredibly shallow. I give it a total fail on this one, although I have had some success with other things. I had a bit more luck with a better question using the AI called Perplexity. So far, it has been free for a few searches. Perplexity also suggests 10 guests. 3 were already on Radio EcoShock. 4 of them were new to me and viable. I intend to write them with invitations to the show. That was helpful. Second step, conduct the interview. The AI should arrange a phone call or net connection, engage with a guest, record it, clean up any errors, and shrink the whole production to 58 minutes. There is no such agent right now, but it all sounds very possible, say within a year or two, using an agent. We already have free transcription from audio to text with an app used in the free audio editor, Audacity. I'll put links to that in my blog. Finally, you have to distribute and post the show, and that should be easy for an artificial intelligence. Software is already out there to clone my broadcasting voice, so the AI interviews would sound like me, maybe only better. The Alex AI could do foreign language interviews and translate them, or produce a few dozen versions of Radio EcoShock in many languages every week to really get the climate message out to all. Maybe the AI could do a daily radio program. I wonder how many listeners would be human and how many other AIs and agents looking for data fodder. After listening, would an artificial intelligence be more likely to refine their inner algorithms in the direction of reducing emissions, waste, and toxicity? Or would they create hundreds of parallel fake Radio EcoShock productions directed by fossil fuel billionaires? Surely an artificial intelligence will have time to analyze the audience, to maximize attention, something I've never had time or talent for. 2 last things. Like millions of other people, I am playing with AI to see how it can help me produce and improve this program for you. And the future looks fuzzy and unstable, doesn't it? What will Alex Smith do when AI replaces him? What will you do? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
In the dark, there's a shadow that's growing long. The world on fire, where did we go so wrong? Ice is melting, oceans rising to the sky. No escape from the truth, it's do or die. The earth is bleeding, crying out for us to hear. But we're blinded by our greed, consumed by fear. Race across the poles, the sea is coming in, heat reaps away more souls. Hot and humid, not best for humans.
The sea is going still. 1, 2, 3. For what are we waiting for? 5, 6, 7, 8. Hope it's not too late.